The lights are on red. We're away.
Hi, welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, October 10th, and this is episode 149. My name is Jules Cisek, and I'm filling in for Bob Hayes. Just wanted to say very sorry about the delay of this show. Typically, my shows are delayed because I have a different schedule of doing things than Bob. I'm delayed compared to Bob's releases, but this time around, I ran into some technical problems. We did a call with Darren Carpenter, and I managed to corrupt the file and had to do a lot of extra work to get that thing to a listenable quality. It's not too bad, actually, at this point, but it took a lot of work, so that's why we're a little bit delayed. There's been a bunch of news this week, but I'm not going to do too much because the call with Darren ran over an hour. Main stuff I wanted to mention was, of course, we had a wonderful race weekend of racing. Troy Bayliss became world champion superbikes. Congratulations to Troy Bayliss. And Mike DiMeglio won the 125cc race and the championship. So congratulations to him. We had a fantastic race in the 250s. If you haven't seen it yet, highly recommend that you watch it. It was pretty much down to the wire. Great battle between two great riders. I'm not going to spoil it. And finally, the silly season is pretty much over with an announcement that Alicia is going to be picking up Mika Kallio from the 250s and Nicola Canepa, who has been testing the Desmos Sedici for Ducati. That isn't 100% confirmed via press release type of thing, but it's looking like a done deal. And so really at this point, the only thing that remains is this possibility of a third Kawasaki and a possibility of a fifth Ducati. And before we jump into the call with Darren, I'll post a link to this. Alberto Puig had a response to some comments that Nicky Hayden made this week, and I just want to spread my hate for this this gentleman, Alberto Puig. He's making me into a hater. So I'm not going to get into what he said, but didn't say. We'll probably talk about it at during a different episode. I'm sure we will, actually. But for now, yeah, I'll just put a link up for that. You guys make up your minds, send in your comments about that, and we will discuss it during the next show. And now we'll get to the highly edited but hopefully still listenable call that I did with Darren Carpenter on Wednesday night. Okay, it's Wednesday evening, and I've got Darren Carpenter on the phone. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Jules?
Good. We are standing in for Bob tonight. Why don't you tell us why?
Yeah, I guess Bob is got himself a date, I guess. I didn't hear it from Bob directly. That's what you told me. So I just wanted to let all of our female listeners know that Bob is still available, but maybe only a short time. You know, they want to send in their picture and maybe a brief description to Bob at MotoGPODO.com. They need to probably do that within the next week or so.
Very good. Yeah, there's still time left. All right. Okay, so we had a very busy motorcycle racing weekend. We had obviously Australia, Phillip Island round in MotoGP, and we had Mac Decore in World Superbikes. So let's talk about MotoGP, since that's what we talk about mostly on this show.
Right. I wasn't able to watch the qualifying or practice. So if you have information about that, maybe you want to start off with qualifying and practice, and then we can start about the race, which I did actually watch.
I actually didn't watch qualifying either. I just watched the like highlights, which basically was primarily the runoff by Rossi. And it was a very, you know, I mean, by the time that I watched it, I already knew that he was fine, except for, you know, like a pulled muscle. But watching it is really, you know, for anybody who rides a motorcycle and knows what it's like to get off into like dirt or grass or anything like that at a reasonable high speed. And he was going like 120. I think I've gone off in the grass at 70 once, and it's just like you just know you're going down. And
yeah.
It's just like how much can you slow down before you go down so you don't totally wipe yourself, you know, hurt yourself and destroy your motorcycle. And
what
just watching him going off, it was like, oh man, it's going to be so bad. He actually didn't come off that bad.
Was it? You said it was. He was doing like 120, so that's actually one of the slower speed turns, I think, isn't it? I mean, that's a Phillip Island is a really high speed track.
Yeah, but I think he. I mean, he was when he was exiting. Actually, well, he was getting on a fairly fast section, but I think he already knew that he was going off, so he probably had hit the brakes. I mean, I just read that he was going about 120 when he hit the grass.
Wow.
And then, you know, then he's just rolling through the grass and at 120 and then hits the gravel and then the bike finally spits him off, so.
Yeah, and I'm not sure what, you know, I've never been to Phillip Island, but I know it's right on the coast. And, you know, if it's at all damp, if there's any kind of moisture on the grass, might as well be ice if you're on slick tires.
Yeah. And it was because the previous day was raining, and it is a very, I mean, if you look at the photos from there, it's like there's a corner there, I think it's Siberia, that is probably like 50 yards from the ocean.
Yeah.
You know? And it's
cold
in Siberia
track.
because it's so it gets some very cold breezes going across it. Yeah, it's an incredible track, and to have a race there in sunny conditions was just really nice for a change, because it's been a while actually since we had a completely sunny Australian Grand Prix.
Was it? I'm trying to think what it was like last year.
It was
remember.
Like, it was like, but, you know, 2 years ago we had that deluge where we had it started off sort of dry and then it went wet.
Right.
It's just an amazing track. You know, all three races didn't have any issues with cold or rain. I mean, it was a little chilly. I think that caught some of the riders out a little bit because they were, you know, playing it for probably a little warmer temperatures, tire selection wise, but
But I've got to expect that that's got to be expected at Phillip Island.
Yeah.
You know, it's very possible to get cold weather. So
yeah. I know a lot of riders, especially Rossi, have been saying that they want to push the Australian round up to like March or April, where it is summer in Australia. But that would be too close apparently to the Formula One round, and they don't want to basically blow their whole wad in one month.
Oh, I see. Yeah, and plus I think, you know, isn't you know, I'm not sure what the schedule, you know, is and how many tracks are like locked in. Isn't Qatar locked in? It's supposed to be always the first race of the year.
I don't know if Qatar is like that. I know it used to be like that with Jerez, and then they put Qatar in beforehand because the temperatures were just so ridiculous during the summer.
Right, but then they had the night race when it was too cold.
Yeah, exactly.
I did hear somewhere though that part of the deal with Qatar was that they were going to be the first race of the year, and they had.
It sounds familiar.
I could be wrong.
I think it sounds familiar. I think I read that somewhere as well. If anybody has that information for sure, please let us know. So anyway, so yeah, I didn't watch qualifying, but you know, obviously the big news was Rossi going off, and then he did end up going out again, but he ran out of time because he spent so much time kind of like getting his wits about, so right. And getting massages and whatever else he was getting, and so he ended up, you know, starting 12th, which kind of was had everybody salivating a little bit because we knew that we would get some passing.
Well, you know, when I sat down to watch the race and I saw the grid and I saw it was in 12th, I thought, you know, it's, first of all, two things about the race before it started was, one, since the championship had already been decided, it kind of takes a lot of the excitement away. You know, you already know who the champion is for the year, so then it's like, well, if people are just going to go out and, you know, have different reasons to do good. Obviously, Stoner wants to win because it's his home race, and I expected that, and I saw Rossi in 12th, and I thought, you know, maybe he's just had a little too much to drink last weekend and didn't really... put a lot into this coming weekend, but I kind of proved wrong during the race.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he was on course for a front row, certainly one of the first two rows on that lap where he went off. So I think he would have probably had a good, you know, closer to the front start, and we would have had a really good battle because his lap times throughout the race were very close to Stoner's. Even though he did say after the race that he really didn't think he was going to be able to catch Stoner after looking at the lap times.
Well, once he got into third place during the race, I didn't think he was. I mean, he was already 5 seconds down, and I didn't think he was going to catch Stoner at that.
No, point. I'm saying that Rossi said that even if he had not started from 12th or had gotten held up by Toseland, I'm kind of jumping around, but you know, that his pace was not quite up there to keep up with. I mean, he was running, you know, like 130.7, 131s when he was on his own. And Stoner was like 130.5, 130.4, 130.8, you know. So he was pulling very, very good laps. Anyway, so let's go back towards the beginning. We had right from the start, we had an incident there because apparently Lorenzo weaved to the left and cut off the Vizioso. The Vizioso was kind of forced onto the side of the... I mean, basically off the track into the dirt, and ended up dead last at the first corner. So, and then, of course, we had Danny Pedrosa crash in the third corner, right?
Oh, no, it was the second corner, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yep, because it's a very fast... It's like you're coming off the super fast Doolin corner and then that second one.
Right.
So... And then it was kind of weird because Vermeulen and Grintoli both went off.
Yeah,
but kind of like it was really delayed reaction. So I'm guessing that it wasn't directly affected that he went down and they were directly affected by it. But like everybody else kind of shuffled around as Pedrosa went down, and those guys had just nowhere to go and had to use an escape route.
Yeah, I watched the first part of that race a few times with Danny Pedrosa crashing, and you couldn't really see what was happening. With, like you say, you saw Danny Pedrosa go off, and the camera follows him, and then all of a sudden, Vermeulen and Sylvain, he goes off as well. But I didn't really see what was causing. I just assumed that it was, like, you know, a start of the race. The first corner is really high speed, and so they don't really, it doesn't look like they even break much for that first corner. It's the second corner they have to kind of set up for, and I thought maybe they were just trying to get position and bumped each other off, or who knows.
It kind of looked like they did a V around Pedrosa, you know? So it's almost like they may have kind of and took some kind of contact with each other and just taken different trajectories out.
Right. But I also noticed when Danny, I don't know if you saw this, but going into that second corner, James Toseland was coming up on the inside of Danny Pedrosa, and it looked like Danny Pedrosa didn't expect him to be there. And so when he made his turn in, he noticed him, made an adjustment, an abrupt adjustment, had to stand the bike up, and then that kind of ruined his line, and the next thing you know, he was off the track.
I'll have to watch that again, because that would make James Toseland a very big part of this race, even more than he was.
Yeah, I think, I like James Toseland now that he's in a MotoGP. When I was watching him in World Superbike, I was never really impressed, but the impression I've gotten since watching him in MotoGP is he does not slow down or give up an inch anywhere. Like, if he can put his bike somewhere, he's going to put it in there. And I would think that Danny Pedrosa would be, he comes from the 125 and 250s. They've raced really close in those classes. But it seems like Toseland is just more like he really wants it. And he doesn't care where you're going to be. He's going to go through.
Yeah, and he's got, a lot more to prove. And he doesn't have to, have results as stellar as some of these other guys, because it's his rookie year. So, because I thought he was actually kind of a pussy towards the end of the World Superbike round, a series last year, when he was leading, but his lead was getting slowly eaten away, and I thought he was riding like a pussy.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of thought he wasn't really going for it. It looked like he was just trying to bring it home. But like I said, when the season started, I didn't expect anything from him. And, he's had some good races and some bad races. I kind of think in the overall championship, I don't even know where he's at right now, but he's had some good results. Yeah, well, he's had some bad races, but he's had some good results. And it seems like the results he's had where he's had some good results, there's been some complaints from other riders about him being, overly aggressive. And I don't know if that's true or not, but he just kind of seems like, hey, I'm sorry if I'm being overly aggressive, but the only place I can pass you is in the turns, and that's where I'm going to pass you.
Right. Yep. Yep. So,
And when I saw when Danny Pedrosa went off, I kind of watched it a few times just to see if it looked like he made an overly aggressive pass, and I don't think he did. It just seemed like Danny Pedrosa overreacted and lost it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, but I think that, I want to see it again, because I think that you may be right. I mean, it did look like he was running out of space also. So there was definitely movement around. I mean, it's a crazy way to start a race. You're full power, and then you don't really hit the brakes through the first corner, but you kind of jostle for position right away. And then you have to slow down. But, it's a very, very fast track. There's only two places on the track that are slow.
Right,
and the rest of it is high speed, flinging back and forth,
that's
why these guys like this track so much.
Plus, the way that track, I don't know the track. I've never been there, but a lot of tracks where they have a long front straight, and you start halfway down the front straight. It might be that, normally when they do a full lap, they're on the front straight. They have to break a certain amount, when they go into turn one, not as much because Phillip Island turn one is really fast, but when they're on the start on the grid and they start, they might not even have to use the brake at all going into turn one, because they might not have gotten to top speed.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true at this track, because my vast knowledge of this track comes from video games and stuff. So that's definitely the case. You can be full on throttle in MotoGP 07 on the PlayStation 2.
All right, well,
going
there
to
you
first
have
corner.
It.
So, anyway, Stoner got an amazing start, and I thought what the amazing thing was that Nicky Hayden got a great start and actually stuck with Stoner.
That was a real surprise.
By lap three, they were already gapping the field by about a second, I think. And the third guy was actually Toseland at that point.
Right, and I think. I think they were able to pull a little bit of a gap because Toseland was in third place. He was running really fast, but he was running a few tenths slower than those guys, and he was running a few tenths slower than what the guys behind him could do, and you could kind of see them starting to pile up behind Toseland. And if you take Toseland out of the picture and you just had Rossi and maybe Lorenzo, they might have been able to stay with that front two with Stoner and Hayden, but...
Not so sure about Lorenzo. I actually picked him to win the race. I really thought this was going to be his second win for the season, and I found his pace a little surprisingly slow, because both his practice times and his qualifying just kind of made me think that he was going to be up there. But you're right. Yeah, Toselin, obviously, it's not just his fault. I mean, he's on, you know, second-tier machinery, although it didn't look like he was missing that much.
It didn't.
Going down the straight. So no, power-wise, I don't think he was hurting.
I think his advantage in that race, in that track, was he had an incredible drive onto the front straight. The last, big bend around leading onto the front straight, he was just, you know, pulling a little bit of a gap there, which gave him an advantage going down the front straight that I think the other guys, even if they had maybe more top end, didn't take advantage of it because they couldn't catch up to him. And then he was
his line was a smarter line. He was able to get the bike upright sooner. I also noticed that when Rossi finally got past him, that's how he was keeping up ahead of him. He was doing the same thing. He was getting the bike upright a lot earlier than the other guys and getting on the power earlier.
Right.
Because of the previous few laps, he wasn't able to do that. Because basically what happened was, you know, we had Rossi cut through the first couple of guys within the first four laps, and then he got stuck in this incredible battle for third place between Lorenzo, Nakano was there, the Vizioso, who, you know, was last, and suddenly was, you know, up there with these guys, Toselin and Rossi. So he had this incredible five bike battle for third place for, I don't know, about six or seven laps.
Right.
Before Rossi finally, and you know, Rossi passed Toselin, and Toselin would repass him, and it would look like Rossi finally made it stick, but somehow Toselin made up the time and passed him again. It was incredible.
Right, and the one time when Rossi got around him, they went to a commercial break, and then they came back, and basically while here in the States, when I was watching TV, I don't know if there was a commercial break in the same spot for everybody else, but Rossi gets around Toselin and then stays in front of Toselin that entire lap, which you would think, you know, okay, now Rossi's got by, he's been able to go a faster pace, he would just pull a little bit of a gap the whole way around, and by the time he got through one lap, he would have been, you know, ahead of Toselin for good. But no, Toselin got back on that, you know, on the front straight and was able to stay in his draft and got back a lap later, so it was pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was really great. But eventually, Rossi did get away from them, and by that time also, because a few laps, while this battle was going on, Stoner finally started to lose Nicky. Stoner's pace was incredibly consistent. He was running low 130s, lap after lap after lap after lap, and then and Nicky was doing the same. I mean, he was, I think Nicky's fastest lap was like 130.1, but then suddenly he dropped into 131s around lap.
Lap
10 or 11. Yeah, you're right. 11, yep.
And then he just started falling back.
What's that?
That's basically where Stoner was able to start gapping him, because Stoner stayed in the 130s all the way till lap 17.
Yeah, yeah, when it was, what did I say, like a short thing. And actually, he picked it back up, didn't he? No, he didn't.
Who?
So, yeah, Stoner had a couple of fast laps still, but yeah, I mean, he had a huge gap at that point. And then, you know, and then we had the battle for fourth was still fantastic all the way through to the end of the race. In fact, we didn't get to see the best part, it sounds like, because at the very, 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 very end, we had Nakano. Well, so the Vizioso got ahead of Toselin and Nakano, and then Toselin put some kind of a move that we didn't get to see it. Toselin put some kind of a move on the Vizioso, and they both ended up getting passed by Nakano, and Vizioso ended up losing out of that bunch, so he ended up in seventh place.
Yeah,
and he actually was a little upset about it.
Well, I didn't see the Vizioso comments, but I did hear Toselin at the end of the race. They were interviewing him, and he said
something like,
"Yeah, I think I made another enemy today."
yeah. But he also said something like, "Yeah, you know, he should know." That's what's going to happen and stuff. So,
yeah.
But then the other amazing thing was, of course, that Rossi actually managed to catch Hayden. And you know, I was thinking about, like, because they were saying, okay, now he's gaining like, you know, 0.2 seconds per sector, but there's only like three laps left. So I was like, yeah, you know, mathematically speaking, yes, but he still has to pass Nicky, and that's going to take some time. Somehow, it just perfectly happened that he ended up at the perfect passing location when he caught Nicky, and was able to get by him really quickly.
Yeah.
So I think he kind of lucked out that he just arrived just in time, or maybe just unbelievable, you know, good timing.
And it also looked like once Rossi got around Toesland and had got third place secured, the thing that surprised me is he didn't really gap Toesland by a lot. It seemed like Toesland was able to stay a second to 2 seconds. Like, he was in the same frame, you know, and they kind of would show Rossi going around the corner. Toesland would be, you know, just behind him by about 5 to 10 bike lengths. And I expected Rossi to get a bigger gap, but, you know, I think that also just goes to show that Toesland, you know, he might have been holding up a few people, but he was going fast. He was railing.
Yeah. And it just really shows how important it is to have that confidence at a track that you really feel comfortable with.
Right.
Because, I mean, I doubt that much has changed, because look at where Edwards ended up, you know?
Right.
So... yeah, so it was a really excellent race. So
I wanted to ask you, did you notice one of the things they showed before, when Rossi was passing Edwards and Nakano, I guess? He did a double pass on the front straight.
Yes, that was those two. Yep.
They came back and showed a replay of it, and the replay was from the camera mounted on the bike that's the clutch hand. And as Rossi was going down the front straight, he turns a knob.
He was adjusting something, yeah.
I wish I knew what he was adjusting.
It's crazy. I mean, that's the fastest part of the track. He's splitting the two guys, and he's like turning this little knob.
And it was funny because it wasn't like an AB switch. It wasn't just like on-off. It was like a knob. Like he's adjusting it, you know, as if three turns is less than four turns, like whatever the adjustment is.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like those little five settings that you've got on your brake lever of like how the distance,
right,
from your or maybe, you know, how much of a clutch lag you've got. But these are GP bikes. The MotoGP bikes. I just can't imagine that, like, there's that much adjustment that has to be made during the race of that kind of
right.
stuff. That was just really bizarre.
I was thinking that it might have something to do with, like, the fuel management. Maybe he was flipping to a different mapping, you know. Maybe
those would be like switches on the other side of the handlebar. This is like literally on the clutch, right?
Yeah, but other side of the handlebar is the gas. You're not going to take your hand off the throttle to make a change to the fuel mapping. Your like crush hand is the hand you want to.
Oh, I know, but I'm just saying the location of this thing that he was turning just seemed odd. Anyway.
Maybe it's a radio knob. Maybe he's adjusting the station.
There you go. Yeah. And, you know, so basically there were like, you know, lumps of riders. Well, there was Stoner. And Nicky and Rossi, I guess, were kind of a lump at the very end. And we had that big lump of Lorenzo, who had a good ride.
Mm-hmm.
Nakano, who had... this was his, I think he matched his best. No, he had a fourth somewhere. And Tozen and Dovizioso in seventh. And then we had Colin Edwards in eighth. And so that next lump was Colin Edwards, Depunier, Caparossi, and Tony Elias. Unfortunately, Tony Elias was the loser of that bunch. So he was in 11th. And then way behind those guys were the Kawasaki's and Chris Vermeulen. Chris Vermeulen had gone off the track, and way behind those guys, of course, Melandri, who was like ridiculously behind. I think he finished like a minute and 30 seconds behind Stoner or something like that.
I think he was a minute and 11 seconds behind the lead. I think he was about to get lapped, I think.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. It was brutal. Brutal.
It is.
And it's just amazing to, I every time I see him fail so miserably, I can't believe that this is the same guy who actually at this track had that, you know, iconic MotoGP moment when he was going to the last corner in that wet race, one arm out and sliding the rear, you know.
Yeah, I've got
super confidence.
I've got that bookmark in my YouTube videos.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I kind of have my doubts to, you know, when he goes to Kawasaki, you know, I just don't know. I don't think he's going to be, you know, I just don't think he's going to do good at Kawasaki. You know, unfortunately, I think he's going to go there for maybe 2 or 3 years, and that's going to be it. I mean, I don't think the Kawasaki's got it yet to be a winning bike. And, you know, I got to think that all of the failures he's had this year has taken a toll on his confidence. You know, I mean,
it's hard to
get that back.
Yeah. Okay, so that was Stoner's fifth win of the season. And what do you think is going to happen in Sepang?
You know, I don't know. Like I said, it's, you know, like in this race might have been an example of how at the end of the season, the championship's over, so you just have a different, you know, some different players up in the front. I'm not sure what's going to happen at Sepang. I mean, I would imagine Stoner's going to do good. I think he's determined, even though he didn't win the championship, he wants to go out on a high note. So I think he's going to go into all the last races.
He does. But he also is risking, you know, if he falls again and hurts his hand, I mean, it could be a career-ending thing. They were talking about the fact that the operation that he has to have in order to be able to keep racing is itself fairly complicated, and there's risk. More risk than usual involved, where if something doesn't go right during the operation, he could his career could be finished. So, you know, on the one hand, if that's the case, then you may as well finish your season as hot as possible before you go to the operating table. But on the other hand, you might want to, you know, be careful. He has fallen 3 times this year, so if he beats Pedrosa, what, you know, is he going to put on the number 2 plate, and what's going to happen? Is Pedrosa going to put on the number 3? I don't know about Pedrosa, but Stoner is definitely not going to be putting on the number 2. He's not a number 2 guy. He's like, it's either number 1 or I'm a loser. It's not like he thinks he's shite or anything like that. I mean, he knows he's great. I mean, he's very confident in his abilities, but he's not going to be like Pedrosa, where like, oh, look, I got second. I beat, you know.
I wonder if Pedrosa's going to put a 3 on his bike.
That's the thing. I don't know. I mean, it'd be kind of weird because 3 is kind of synonymous at this point with Biaggi and MotoGP. But, you know, the top 3 plates are reserved for the guys who finish in that order in the championship.
I thought it was the top 5. Is it just the top 3?
I think top 3, you can demand it. If you, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't think there's a rule about it, except for the number 1 plate. So,
I just remember I watched the Colin Edwards responses on YouTube to the questions that were posted.
Right. That's right.
It's number 5, and he said he got the 5th place in MotoGP, and was hoping that would bring him luck, like it did when he had his number 5 plate in World Superbike.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I watched that too.
But he has just kept the number, and there's been other people that have finished in 5th place, so you're right. It doesn't like they have to give it up.
Right.
I'm not sure what the actual
rule
is.
I mean, Barros had 4 forever, you know, and he was certainly wasn't 4th all the time, so.
Yeah.
But he did get it when he was 4th, so. Anyway, do you want to do a quick World Superbike thing before we talk about...
Yeah, I think we should. I mean, Troy Bayliss got the championship. I think he's, you know, we need to mention that at least.
His
swanson season. It was funny when I watched the race. I watched both of those races, and I knew ahead of time, before I watched it, that Haga won the race, one of the races. I thought he won both of the races. And so when I was watching it, the first race he won, and then the second race I thought Haga won as well, and I'm a big Troy Bayliss fan. I really wanted him to lock up that championship. I didn't want him to delay it any longer. And at the very last lap, when Troy Bayliss got into the lead, and he had a little bit of gap on Haga, and I was just on the edge of my seat. I thought for sure Haga won, so I was like, oh no, he's going to crash. And I was biting my nails the whole way. I'm like, don't crash. And he didn't, and he won the championship. So good for him.
Yeah. It was amazing, and you could just tell the difference in that second race because he was already so relaxed.
Yeah,
you know, having wrapped it up in the first one.
Right.
So.
He's won three championships now, and he's won it on three different bikes, and he's won it with the control tire, and he's won it without the control tire.
And over a seven-year period. So that's, you know, because his first championship was 2001, so that's a long time ago.
Right.
It's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome. Yeah, he had 998, 999, and 1098.
And the first one of 2001, Ducati had an advantage because the V-twins were allowed 1,000 cc's, and I think still at that time the four cylinders were only allowed up to 750. And so you could say, well, he won because he had a better bike. And then if he won again later, I think it was the 1,000s, you know, he won last year. Or was it last year that he won? 2 years ago, and that was the thousands, you know, was at equal terms as far as CCs, 1,000 CCs on the four cylinders and on the two cylinders. And then this year he had the Ducati, you know, basically the 1,200 CC, the 1098. And so,
with a little bit of extra weight on it, but, you know, and obviously the bike was not the reason why he won because the other Ducatis didn't do nearly as well.
No, and I remember at the very beginning of the year, they were talking about how they had allowed the Ducati, you know, they allowed the twin-cylinder bikes the bigger capacity, but they were going to monitor that, and if they had an advantage, they would, you know, add weight to take away the advantage. Yep. And I remember watching it, and it was, you know, Ducati was kind of risky, but they would have to add more weight, and it was only because of Bayless.
Yeah, there was, because he won a couple of races in the beginning. He won a double in Phillip Island, and everybody was like, "Uh-oh," but I think by the end of the season, it was obvious that Suzuki and especially Yamaha really had a great package as well, and that Ducati didn't really have an advantage in that sense. They just had Bayless.
Right, and in the Honda even, didn't have as much success, but at certain tracks they were successful, and I think they had a better top speed. So, yeah, there was no advantage, really, clear advantage with any of the bikes.
Yeah. Although you could definitely tell that, you know, that V-twin power coming out of a corner is still formidable.
Yeah.
You know.
But I think that the disadvantage is the four cylinders have a higher top speed.
Yes. Yep.
So,
yep.
Give and take.
Yep. Hey, yeah, so it was good racing. I found the second race especially interesting. There was a lot of passing going on. There was a lot more strategy. The first one it's kind of typical of World Superbike racing where it's a lot closer, but you still end up with like not that much passing sometimes, you know? There's some races where that's totally thrown out the window and it's just madness all around. But there's some tracks that just don't seem like they're particularly well designed for passing. I think there was a really good comment. I think it was on Ride On 2 in the forums about how Laguna Seca and Phillip Island and some of those tracks that are like that, where there is no place really to let off and just, you know, get on the power and use just the power of your bike. That those tracks, it's really the track, not necessarily like the components that determine, the quality of the race, where quality is like the closeness of the race. Because I think Magny-Cours has a very interesting layout that does there's a lot of, you know, I would say half of the lap is there's really not much passing, but the other half there's lots of passing opportunities, and you can be very crafty, like especially the final bits where you go through the really crazy little chicane, and
right. There's
many ways that people have, you know, are trying to go through it and get some advantage onto the straight so they can get, you know, on the power earlier, and that I think that's why we saw good racing.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, it's definitely the track that has the biggest play as far as, you know, how the racing's going to go. Some tracks are just set up, you know, they're just better. There's just more passing zones. There's less area to really, like you say, have an advantage with, like, horsepower. Laguna Seca, you know, there's really no big long straights at Laguna Seca. It doesn't matter what kind of bike you're going to take there. They're all going to have the same top speed or very close to it. And, you know, it makes for good racing. The Magna Core race, the one thing about that track, as I was noticing, and I think this is the only track that I know of, there's a particular corner, and I don't know the names of the corner. I don't remember which one it is, but, you know, it's a real a hairpin kind of corner. They really have to brake hard, and you'll see the bikes coming down the straightaway,
right,
and
they're
backing it in. But they sometimes they'll back it, you know, if you're watching it on the screen, so it's reverse, but they're going to the, you know, left of the screen, so for them it's a right-hand turn. And they'll drift the back end of the bike over towards the right hand, over towards the turn. And normally you see them drift like the back end, you know, so it kind of squares off the turn. So it's a really weird looking turn. You'll watch those guys and they're backing it in and actually kind of dragging their bike in towards the corner with the rear wheel. It's just
strange. I know exactly what you're talking about. I thought it was some kind of an illusion. Like I thought it was such an optical illusion because everybody was doing it.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, you watch it and it's just like, what are they doing? And it looks like they're out of control.
Yeah.
Maybe it is an optical illusion. I don't know. But and there were several guys that they would come in into that corner, and they would come into the inside. So they'd come into the right, and then right before the corner, they would just drift all the way back out to the left and then make the corner. And I think it was the first race that where there was a pack of, you know, and the first race, I think the first half of the race, it was like seven guys right on top of each other. And the last person in that group, he was doing that, just a radical move all the way across, you know, to change his line right before the turn. And I kept thinking to myself, I'm glad I'm not behind him.
Now I want to go and watch that. That corner again, because there was some time ago that I saw something weird going on, and it turned out to be some kind of illusion where, like, because of the depth of field of the camera was such an incredibly long way away, it made the bike look like it was moving sideways, but in reality it was actually still going to the corner. So I want to see it again.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's a very quick wrap-up of World Superbikes. And, you know, they've got one round left, so two more races, and that's it. And we've got a champion, obviously, so it's going to be just all for fun.
Right. It's going to be a lot of interesting.
What's that?
Like you say, it's a championship's over. Everybody's out. This is his last race weekend, so, you know, he's going to go out and try to have a go out with a bang.
Right. Hopefully, you know, it's a safe bang. And, and we, you know, and then we've got two more rounds of MotoGP. I think Valencia is going to be a very exciting race. Nobody's got anything going except to win, right? Like, there's no pressure to win, to do anything other than win the race. And I think it should be really fun.
Is there anybody that can save their job in these last two races, or been determined?
Nakano is still hanging by a thread of possibility that he can pick up that third Kawasaki ride that's being rumored. But it really sounds like they want a Spanish rider on that bike. So,
and is that for sure? I've been hearing the third Kawasaki for a while, and
it's getting, you know, it's still silly season-ish type of stuff, but it's looking pretty solid at this point.
And will it be a satellite team, or will it be just a third factory bike?
I think it's going to be so because it's going to be run by Aspar. I think that it's a factory bike, but it might not be a green team bike. I think it might have some other sponsors. So
okay.
So it's going to be kind of like Nakano's Grassini, you know. And actually, next year's Elias Grassini. It's supposed to be a factory as well, so that should be interesting. And then, you know, then we've got the biggest question mark is who's going to be riding those other two Ducatis? We still have absolutely no idea. I mean, Canepa is a very likely choice.
That's the test rider?
That's the test rider, Nicola Canepa.
Yeah, and that's what
I heard. And the other guy is Mika Kallio. But neither one of those is confirmed yet, so...
And wasn't we'll Sete Gibernau?
And then there's also this fifth Ducati, which... I don't know what the status of that thing is at this point. I haven't heard anything about it for a couple of rounds. I think Bruno was the last time they talked about it. And, that would be one of the most amazing comebacks into the sport, actually, to see Sete Gibernau return. I would love to see it, especially if he could actually do what he was doing during the testing, which was making much, much better lap times than Marco Melandri.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, so we're about 45 minutes in. Let's talk about the real reason why I wanted to talk to you is because we want to get a racer's perspective of this whole tire debacle.
Right, and also, I just want to mention I've listened to you and Bob for the last few podcasts talk about the tire control, and I feel like I'm listening to Fox News. Because we're just getting one side of the story,
so
all against tire controls.
That's so wrong. That's so wrong. We're fair and balanced, goddammit. All right. Hit me.
Well, let me. I made a few notes here, points that I wanted to talk about. And the first few, I think we both.
Shut up.
On.
Shut up. Shut up. That's enough of you. All right? I'm not going to have you here bad-mouthing my sport. All right. Sorry. You started it. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so the first few points, I think, first of all, I wrote down a few of the topics that people mention when they talk about control tires and whether it be for or against control tires. And so when I hear these things, it makes my mind rattle because I have an opposing opinion and I think they're not really expressing themselves and not explaining it correctly. Not you guys, but just in general. You hear the riffraff on the forums and stuff. And so one of the things I wanted to mention is you hear how, and I have this in no particular order, but one of the topics is that Bridgestone and Michelin, they don't want to have a control tire either. Now, we've already have a control tire at this point, so I'm not sure what their opinions are now, but as of like 2 weeks ago, they were both like, we don't want a control tire. And I think that's understandable because their role right now, or I should say their role this last season, Bridgestone and Michelin, is a completely different role than if it's a control tire. If it's, if they're just going out and developing a tire for a particular factory team, be it Suzuki or Kawasaki, then they have, input with the riders and the bikes, and they can make adjustments, and they can have a program for that. If you have to have a program where you're going to supply tires to the entire grid, it's a completely different program. You're not developing a tire specific to one team. You're trying to develop a tire that everybody can use. And then it's also, there's less reward because the only thing you're going to get is criticism. Nobody's going to come out and say, oh, this is a great tire. They're going to say, well, I couldn't do this because of this. And if the tire wasn't good, they're going to mention it. And since it's the same tire that everybody has, it's just going to be a critical opinion of that tire. The same way as it was or it is now with Pirelli and World Supersport. I don't think that they...
So hang on a second. Before we go too far, realize they're not calling it a control tire. They're controlling it. It's a spec tire, which is a little bit different. Because all it really means is there's a single manufacturer providing tires. There's nothing in the provisions that say that everybody gets the same tire.
True. But what I was just mentioning was that Pirelli goes into World Superbike. They're the tire. And so there's no better tire. They can't compare it and say this person had an advantage. There's only... this tire is this way and it, didn't last long or it didn't have grip in the beginning or it didn't have, enough grip in the middle. And so I think you're just getting, even if you're developing a tire, you're still going to get that same criticism. And now the way it was this year, you would get criticism on tires if they were the worst, if they were the lesser of the tire that day.
Right, right. That's true. That's true. What's your point?
I'm just saying that's how I think it's a different program. So I don't think that they're against the control tire because of the, you know, the idea that it needs to be this pure form of competition. I think they're against it just because it's a completely different program.
Yeah, and they get a lot less out of it because, I mean, you know it's like bragging rights go straight out the window, and you also take more of a burden on the cost too. Because I mean, I imagine that the FIM and Dorner, especially Dorner, I mean, I don't think FIM has those kinds of funds. They're going to be subsidizing these tires to the teams. That's one of the reasons why they wanted to do it, is they want to lower the costs. So, you know, there's not as much money to be made in it directly, which is probably, you know, very small compared to the actual, you know, advertising money that you're losing by not being able to say, hey, we beat Michelin or whatever. I don't know how, you know, I don't know how much that really matters, because on one hand, you could also say, well, we were so good that Michelin
right.
didn't even bother, you know.
Well, they still get the marketing. I mean, the marketing is just getting your name out there. So
yeah,
they'll have their
yeah.
name plastered everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it worked with them for Formula One, so.
Right. Right. And I don't know if necessarily the cost, you know, the cost is a different formula altogether as well, because if you're just providing particular team tires and you're competing against another brand in Michelin, you're, and let's say if you're Bridgestone and you're competing against Michelin, you're going to have an incentive to put more money into research and development. Where if you're the only tire on the grid, you know, it's a different. I'm not sure if it's less money or more money, but I just think it's a different formula. You're not necessarily going to have to put in as much money into development because everybody's on your tire,
and you can do
development in a different way as well. So
right, no, exactly, and I think that is the second point that Espeleta made when introducing the rule, was that he wants the development to slow down. He wants the development of these particular race tires to slow down, and it will, because there's not going to be as much competition there. There's not as much reason for them to really be developing anything radically new.
Right.
You know, that's one of my criticisms, but keep going.
Okay, well, let's talk about the tire development, because I think that, say, for example, Pirelli goes into World Superbike. I actually think that you can make an argument that for tire development, it's better to be the control tire, because on a given weekend, Pirelli has over 100 top racers all using their tires. They've got it on all the different kinds of sport bikes out there, so they can put out a tire. They can see how everybody does. It's not whether a particular team has a new chassis or a new component or a new part. Maybe they do, but you're seeing that when you make a change in a tire, how does that change affect the performance over the whole range of bikes and a whole range of riders? So I don't necessarily, you can't do a direct comparison. You can't say, well, Pirelli was good this week and they're, you know, better or worse this week compared to Michelin or Dunlop or Bridgestone. But I think just generally speaking that they are still doing tire development. And if you look at the Pirelli tires, since they've been in World Superbike, their tires every year have gotten better. And again, you can't necessarily say whether it's what level of improvement it is, because you don't have a direct comparison. But they are still doing research. Their tires are getting better. I don't know about other national series, but I know in the U.S. that 6, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, you know, pretty much Dunlop dominated and Pirelli was really nowhere. And Dunlop still wins because they still have the contracts with the factory riders. But Pirelli has made quite of improvements with their tires, you know, at the national level. And they've got a lot more people on Pirelli tires.
They do. And, you know, Metzler makes their street tires. So something's going on there. I mean, you know, Pirelli's been in the shit before too, so actually in competition, so they know how to make tires,
right?
But again, you know, so I think when it comes to the actual manufacturing parts of the of the debate. It's just useless to argue because even the FIM put out a statement today that, you know, here's what they said. They said, from the Federation's point of view, one of the main characteristics of the Motorcycle Road Racing World Championship is that it is a prototype championship and as such is unlimited in all respects, including tire manufacturers. This is a philosophy which the FIM has always defended and will continue to defend. And then they later go on to say that this is actually kind of heartening, is that they say that this particular rule is only going in for no more than 3 years, and then they're going to reevaluate it. So that's good to hear. But anyway, so my point is that all those aspects of we've Bob and I have talked about tire development trickling down to the end user. The fact of the matter is that, you know, I can see that development is not going to stop completely. And in fact, there's lots of incentives for Bridgestone to develop anyway, because they still have to compete against Michelin and Dunlop and all these guys in the real world. So there's no reason why to stop development.
Right.
But, and I made this point last time I talked to Bob, is I just don't like the fact that we have a rule in MotoGP that limits a component by manufacturer instead of like by some kind of like other thing, like saying, oh, well, you know, the rubber has to be this type and you can only use two compounds and it has to be exactly this profile or something like that. But to say that the tire can only be made by a certain manufacturer, there's no other component that's controlled in this way,
right?
Well, and that's odd for a prototype series.
Correct. And I think, you know, I'm not necessarily for or against the control tire, but the reason why I support the control tire, and my sole reason, is the fact that I think the way it should be in a perfect world is if Honda or Suzuki or Kawasaki or any of the teams, if they want to switch tire brands, they should be able to switch tire brands. If everybody were to switch to Bridgestones, let's say, because Bridgestone was a better tire, and Michelin still wanted to be in the game, then, in a capitalist system, then Michelin would need to go to a team and say, look, we will make you a tire. We'll cut you a deal on the price. We want to make sure it's a good tire, so we're going to give you, you know, a lot more development time. We want to be back in the lead. And eventually, them doing that, they would develop a better tire because they would have the possibility to develop a better tire because they would be working solely with a less number of people. If Bridgestone had to support more people, then they couldn't develop a tire specific to an individual team. Their development would have to be more general, which would mean their development would probably slow down. But the way it is now, it's almost like the tire manufacturers have a say, and they can say, no, we're only going to support five teams, or we're only going to support, you know, a certain number of teams. And if another team wants to, you know, to use our tires, we're not going to support them. And so I think it's just crazy to think that factory Honda, it can't just change tires whenever they want to change tires. I almost look at it like it should be considered just another supplier of a part that they use. Like if they wanted to switch from Repsol to Motorex or to Motul oils, then they should be able to do that if one of them gives them an advantage.
Well, I don't think that HRC could switch from Repsol to Motul.
No, but my point is if they found somebody that made a better fuel, a gas fuel, or if they made...
Yeah, no, I totally hear what you're saying. I mean, like, but the thing is that every single component is a sponsor. Is made by a sponsor in a way, so there is, you know, this precedent for like, well, contracts have been signed and it's not so easy to just move from one component to another. It's just very extremely visible in the tire world, but I'm sure that it would be the same issue if somebody wanted to go from Brembo to something else on the brakes. I don't know if there's anybody else that uses something other than Brembo out there, but on MotoGP, but were there another, you know, a different breakout there? I'm sure those guys have contracts too, and it would be just as big of a battle. Just it would be behind the scenes; nobody would give a shit about it, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, anymore nowadays, it's like, what is a contract really worth? I mean, they break contracts right and left with riders, with teams. you know, so.
Well, that's true. And I think, that is true. And I think that the more visible it is. I totally agree. I think that would be awesome if what Pedrosa did this year was, instead of being looked as foolhardy and ridiculous, was looked at, hey, that's pretty smart. You know, it wasn't working out for him in the Michelins. Let's go to the Bridgestones, you know. I don't have a problem with that at all. I think that I want see that's the kind of competition I do want to see. I want to see, and it almost happened because Michelin and Ducati were talking about, you know, going off and Ducati going fully to Michelin, all five bikes, you know, the four
right.
definite bikes and the fifth nebulous one and the Kawasaki getting Kawasaki to come along. So,
well, and let's talk about that for a bit. I mean. What Ducati did, I think this was kind of known, is a few years ago they switched to Bridgestone because they knew if they wanted to compete and beat Rossi, they weren't going to get the same support that Rossi was getting from Michelin, so they had to go to Bridgestone.
Exactly.
And
they wanted to be the top guy with the tire manufacturer,
right?
And that's what they became.
But I don't think, like, at the end of this year, let's say Ducati said, okay, we, you know, now that Rossi's on Bridgestones, we don't feel we're going to get the same support as Rossi, so we're going to go through a whole nother development cycle. We're going to take the next 2 or 3 years to develop our bike with Michelin's. You know, I would think that's for Casey Stoner. It's like, you know, and for Ducati as well. It's like we've done all this work to get to the top, and as soon as we get to the top, we can't enjoy it for more than a year because now we're having to switch back to another tire to chase after the championship. I'd rather see Stoner and Ducati, if they want to stay on Bridgestones, it seems like their bike has been developed around the Bridgestone tire, and it seems like the Bridgestone tire has been developed around their bike. And I only say that because I've read that the, you know, Rossi, Yamaha, and the Suzuki factory team have kind of modeled what their bikes, you know, their setup on their bikes to what the Ducati setup is to get the best use out of those tires. And I wouldn't want to see them have to throw that all away just because that, you know, now the tires have, you know, gone to the other teams and they want to start all over again.
On the other hand, can you imagine if they went back to Michelin's and still kicked ass? Talk about bragging rights in the manufacturer camp. So,
true.
You know, there's you know, and frankly, I mean, Michelin's are not like crap. They were crap for 3 rounds this year and that's it.
Right, and that was something else I wanted to mention, was the fact that I kind of did a little study, and I went back and looked at all of the race results for the entire year, and I just took the top 10 positions, because one, there's only like 18 bikes on the grid.
Right.
Two, there's more Bridgestone riders than there are Michelin riders. So I thought, well, to kind of narrow down this selection, I'm just going to take the top 10 positions and see, you know, of those top 10 for each race, how many of them were on Bridgestones, how many of them were on Michelin's. And if you look at it, you're right. There really isn't any advantage. It's basically like one race weekend, there'll be 6 Bridgestones and 4 Michelin's. The next race weekend, there'll be 6 Michelin's and 4 Bridgestones. And it kind of goes that whole route until those 3 races, Germany, Laguna, and the Czech race. And those 3 races were the races that Bridgestone had a clear advantage. And, you know, really, so if you look at it, like, yeah, individually, the whole race, that's a 17-race season. Out of those 17 races, it's pretty much even all the way through. So,
and you've got, a couple less Michelin riders than you do.
Right, right. I agree. Yeah. So it's not a foolproof study, but I'm just kind of getting an idea of,
sure,
like,
sure,
really
sure. I took it even a step further, which is, like, let's remove the biggest variable of all, Valentino Rossi, and let's remove his results as if he didn't even exist. And then the
right.
picture is even more interesting, because then it's like Michelin actually, you know, kind of kicked ass. If it wasn't
for
Rossi.
They kicked ass.
Sorry. It would have been even on wins, but they would have had more podiums.
Well, I was looking at the top 10.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
So
talking about.
In the top 10, they would have had a, I don't think they would have had a huge advantage. But individually, I think over the whole season, it's not a big deal. But if you're, let's say, Danny Pedrosa or Casey Stoner or Rossi, let's say Casey Stoner and Danny Pedrosa, and you want to go for the championship next year, if you know that the tires you have are going to be on par for every race except for 3 races, there's going to be 3 races you're going to have to bag because your tires aren't going to be up to performance. You can't compete against Rossi knowing that out of the 17 races, you're only going to have 14 races to deal with. Mm. I mean, you can still win the championship, but, you know, you have to count on Rossi having some bad finishes and having some crashes and having some wrecks. I mean, you take away those three races, and it actually makes an effect on the championship.
Okay. But you know, I'm not sure where you're going with that, because
so
what
I'm
sounds like
that,
to me is like we should just get rid of Rossi and then everything will be fine.
No, I'm not saying get rid of Rossi. I'm just saying that if you're trying to get a championship, you want to have the best materials you can have available to you. If you're Danny Pedrosa, well, first of all, you can only go with the factory team that you're signed with. So if you're Hopper, you're on a Kawasaki. If you're Vermeulen, you're on a Suzuki. And that's not going to change until your contract ends and you get lucky enough to get a better contract with some other team. But, you know, you're developing the bikes with those factories, so you're hoping that you can develop a winning bike. But beyond that, all of the other equipment, you know, brake pads, shocks, brakes, fuel, oil, you should be able to say, look, I want the best equipment available as I build this bike so I can compete for the championship. If you're, say, Hopper and you're on Kawasaki, then, okay, you know you're not going to be competitive next year. You know you're not going to be winning a championship. So it probably behooves you to put some time into development to develop a winning bike and also to work with the tire manufacturers to give yourself a tire that matches your bike and your riding. And so you're going to be more apt to say, okay, I know there's going to be some races where I'm not going to have a chance, but that's just part of the development. But if you're already at the top and you're trying to fight for a championship, I would think you'd want the best materials around.
No, I hear you, and I see where you're going with this, and I think that when you consider how incredibly important the tire is, it makes even more sense in that, obviously, that you want the best. I think that we need to talk about why the riders want this, right? So that's what we're talking about right now. Why the riders want a single tire rule. There's very few that say they don't. Like Vermeulen has actually come out and said he doesn't, and like Dovizioso and I think Caparossi said they don't really care. But the rest of them are pretty much all saying, yeah, single tire. But if you really gave those guys the opportunity, they would all want to race the same. Rossi certainly would love to have a chance to fight against these guys, the top guys, on exactly the same equipment. Because he really wants, I mean, he would love to just show that it's really, 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 really him. It's not him plus Bridgestone plus this year's Yamaha or whatever, right? He just wants to show that he's the best rider. So I think that exists in a lot of these guys, and in some of them that where it doesn't, they don't really have the winning kind of spirit. Like I think you were talking about Hopper. I hate to say it, but I think Hopper's going around for a paycheck these days. I mean, a year or 2 years now, he's been going around for a paycheck. He doesn't really have that winning spirit anymore.
You might be right, and I wanted to mention something when you mentioned Dovizioso, just to kind of backtrack a little bit here. He's actually the interesting one. He said he mentioned he didn't really care if there was a control tire or not.
Yeah.
Of those three races where Michelin didn't do very good, Dovizioso was actually, I think, one of the better Michelin riders.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
I think that he finished fourth in Laguna. He finished fifth, didn't he?
Fourth. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty insane.
And that was the track that was the track that all the Michelin riders were saying it was crap.
Yeah, yeah.
Which would make you think there wouldn't be a Michelin tire in the top 10.
Yep.
But anyway, I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah. No, Dovizioso is a very intriguing guy, and it'll be very interesting to see how he does it at HRC. He's never had, I mean, he has one world championship, 125s. He's never had top machinery. So it's one of those cases where it's like you could almost see him like turning into like another Biaggi, where not in terms of being, you know, like whiny about his stuff, because he's never said anything negative about his equipment, but it was obvious in the 250s that he was an underpowered bike and still really doing well. And it's quite possible that a guy like him excels when he's the underdog. But
right.
As soon as you put him on the top machinery and he's expected to do really well and win races like all the time, he's going to have too much pressure on him and will fold up. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm really looking forward to seeing how he does at HRC.
Right. I mean, I think to kind of go along with your point, it's like if you're on a lesser equipment, you're going out there knowing that you really have to push hard. You really have to ride.
And then no one's going to blame you for not winning. And they're going to be like really super impressed if you get second.
Right.
You know?
There's no pressure. But as soon as you're on the best equipment, it's like, okay, now there's no reason why you shouldn't be winning the race.
So anyway, so the thing is, I think that if the riders were to make the rules, I think that we would end up with a very different kind of series. And that's why I don't take their say, you know, like Rossi is very much for the control tire. Hayden is for the control tire. Those are two guys that I really admire in MotoGP. Actually, Stoner was the other guy who said he doesn't really care. That's right. It was Stoner and Dovi. But that's Stoner's attitude in general. He's like, he always tries to come off that way. Those guys have to, their opinions have to be put aside, actually, even though they're the ones who are racing, because I think it needs to be the fans. So I think the fans want closer racing. And Dorna wants closer racing because they want to draw in the bigger crowds, money, all that kind of stuff, viewership.
Well, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree on that topic, because I don't think the riders would want to give up their prototyped racing bikes. I think they like the fact that they're on a prototype machine. They're part of the development process. They're on a bike that is the pinnacle of motorcycle racing. But I think the frustration, I'm guessing, would come from the fact that the one component that makes the biggest difference, they don't have the choice or they don't have an option to just pick up and use. Like, they can't just switch between Michelins and Bridgestones. It doesn't seem like, at least the way the rules were written for all these years up until this last week, that one team couldn't just say, okay, look, at the end of the year, we've got a contract with Michelin, but we're not going to go with Michelin the next year. We're going to go with Bridgestone. It's almost like there has to be, you know, in the past, it's like there had to be a certain number of Michelin teams and a certain number of Bridgestone teams. And, you know, if you wanted to switch, it's almost like they had to do a reorganization of who was on what.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I hear you. I didn't mean to make that sound like that was, you know, I was just making a very extreme point, right? Like, I think that you're absolutely right. Being at this level, MotoGP, going to MotoGP isn't just about, you know, it's like the Formula One guys, right? They're not driving around in stock cars. they're driving around in one-offs. I mean, there's something really, really special about that. And
right.
I think that the fact that, you know, you could be very surprised every single year with what those guys come up with in the factory up there is actually a big part of the adrenaline rush that these guys get, you know, as they get on the next year's bike and they go, oh my God, what did they come up with this time? All this technology that's being developed is very, very cool. But yeah, so okay, fine. But I still think that their opinions should be put aside for this particular discussion because they have a completely different view of this than we do. I think that for example, if you took a grid full of Stoners, then we would end up with a series where you'd have runaway races because that's what he believes in. You know, it's like, we're the majority, right? The fans are the majority, and we want closer racing. And I think that's been used as a carrot for this tire thing, saying, you know, we're going to have closer racing. We're going to have closer racing because there's not going to be this disparity between the Michelins and the Bridgestones, and the Bridgestones are all going to be closer together as well, which means that there's not going to be like a team that's favored over another team. So in some sense, I agree. However, you know, I think that the reason why the racing has gotten less exciting, like in terms of like, you know, passing on the last lap and, you know, winning by 1/1000 of a second like we had in 2006, I think it's because we went to the 800 series. I mean, we went down from the 990s to the 800, and all this other stuff. It's just going to follow now because what we have is Espoleta saying, well, you know,
Well, so first of all, we went down to 800s to slow the bikes down, supposedly. And there's lots of conspiracy theories that, you know, whatever. I don't really buy into any of that Honda stuff. If they did have a conspiracy theory where if they really were conspiring, they really, really failed epically. But I think that the move, you know, down to the 800s, for whatever reason, we had the 800 series. We'd expected the lap times to fall. They didn't, because the bikes, the manufacturers found ways to get the bike through the corners, keep the corner speeds up, and now we have this issue where the corner speed is too high, and you're actually starting to run out of runoff area in the tracks, and that's a serious safety issue, right? I mean, like, you know, you can put up air fences as much as you want, but you just have to look at Pedrosa's crash in Sachsenring to see just how dangerous it can get. You know, that bike flying up in the air, you hit a wall and the bike lands on you. It doesn't matter whether the thing was made, whether the wall was made out of, you know, foam or anything like that.
Well, and like you say, I mean, I think there's a limit. I mean, when they make these, you know, over the last 10 years, they've gone to all of the tracks they've gone to and, you know, asked for safety improvements, additional runoff. But there gets to be a point where it's like you can't, you know, there's only so much runoff that you're going to have before you're going to push the fans like a mile away.
Or you know, well, there's some tracks where you'd have to go into the other side of the track to get any more runoff because there's like a narrow bend left in between the two sections. So, no, I mean, I think that some tracks would have to be dropped and special tracks would have to be developed, and we don't. That's a way, way, way too expensive of a thing because it's not just a track, but it's like the entire venue, the fans, the fan base there. I mean, like you're not going to drop Mugello. You're not going to drop, well, I guess they have been talking about dropping Australia, but not Australia, but Phillip Island, moving it to what's the other course inland?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah,
but I mean, a track that they would have to be considered if they were going to try to additional runoff would be a track like Laguna Seca, and even though Laguna Seca doesn't get the same numbers of people there, it's an important track because it's in a big market. You know, it's in California. It's the U.S. So they need to have a race out here just for the fan base.
Yeah, yeah. But so the thing is that I buy the argument that if development of the tire slows, then you're not going to keep getting faster and faster corner speeds. However, I think what's going to happen is that the electronics are going to get so much more sophisticated to like kind of make up for the tire development that the bikes are still going to be super fast to the corners and getting faster lap times, and then they're going to go after the electronics next, and we're going to start getting way too many of these rules. And I think that I agree with the writers who said originally in the safety meetings that give us back the 990s, because even though the speeds were fast down the straight,
they were slower
in the corners because they didn't have to be so goddamn fast. And there were so many different ways to ride the bike.
Right.
You know,
I agree.
You'd have to turn off. You'd have to get rid of some of the traction controls so that you could let the guys back it in more than they are right now. And, you know, so there's, I mean, I would start arguing that now you're going too far the other way because you do want that development. The traction control development is actually very interesting technology and it should be developed.
Right.
But I like the fact that, you know, there's an on-off switch.
Well, and then a few things about, and we can kind of wrap this up here because it's getting late for me. But
Yeah, that's true.
A few things I wanted to mention is you were talking about how they're selling this idea because it'll make the racing closer. And this is something I think I agree with you on. I don't think it's going to make the racing closer. I think what it's going to do at most is out of the 17 races, I think there's going to be a handful, 3-4 of those races that might have the potential of being closer. But it's not going to be like World Superbike. World Superbike is just a production-based bike. Those bikes don't change nearly the same way that they do in MotoGP. They've got like 35 bikes on the grid, I think, for a World Superbike race, where in MotoGP they have, you know, less than 20.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think it's going to really make that much of a difference on whether the races are close or not. You know, I think that basically we've been privileged to be watching MotoGP during the Rossi era, where he likes to race and battle against people, and he's given us a great show. But people like Stoner and McDoohan, they just want to run and win. And they're going to stretch out a lead as far as they can.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
But the point I wanted to make was that I think they should be able to pick and choose whatever tires they want whenever they want. I understand that it's a team decision. They're developing a bike, so they're not going to. It's not really worth their while to change the mid-season. I don't really understand why Danny did that. I mean, I kind of do, but that's why I would be for pro of control tire or spec tire. Is the fact that if you're not going to be able to supply everybody on the grid, then we'll figure out a way to do it.
Right. No, it's good. It's a good point, and I appreciate you making it. And I'm not disagreeing with you even. I think that everything you've said makes sense.
All right. Well, good.
But I'm not convinced. I'm just saying,
Well, that's fine. I wasn't trying to convince you. Just trying to give a fair and balanced podcast.
Right on. Right on. Well, Dan, thanks very, 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 very much. And I hope, let's give a big shout out to Bob, who's out there. Hopefully,
yeah.
Still out there.
I hope you had a good time tonight, Bob.
Yeah. And remember, if time's running out on Bob.
Right. Send your photos and description to Bob at MotoGPOD, and he'll be reviewing those next week, and maybe he'll email you.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. Good night.
Talk to you later, Jules. Bye. Bye.
That was my cat. Okay, so that's it for the show. Thank you for downloading it. Sorry about the delay. And we'll be talking to you next week when we have show 150, another milestone for MotoGPOD. Until then, be safe out there. And, do a lot of good stuff like keep the rubber side down, sun side up. Take care. Ciao.